Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Elliot Ackerman, author of Red Dress and Black, published by Knopf on May 26th. Elliot, a national book finalist, is the author of Waiting for Eden, Dark at the Crossing, and Green on Blue, as well as the memoir Places and Names. He writes for Esquire, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, New York Times, Best American Short Stories, Best American Travel Writing. He's been a White House fellow and is a Marine who served 5 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan with a Silver Star, a Bronze Star, and a Purple Heart. So Red Dress and Black and White is a novel about a place most of us don't know, a time most of us don't know, and a people most of us don't know. In addition to meeting the woman in the red dress, real person Seda Songur, her photographer Osman Orsal, real people, we also meet and know William, Catherine, Marat, Dennis, Peter, Kristen, and a host of minor characters drawn in detail. Each of these people interact in seemingly normal relationships, but there are shocks, surprises, and complications. The worlds of art, sexuality, revolution, politics, spying, business, romance, and childhood are intricately woven into the tale and drawn tighter and tighter as the work progresses. And hovering over all this is the lady in red, the lady in red dress and white tote bag, a symbol literally and figuratively of Turkey, and the figurehead of a movement, perhaps fatally flawed, perhaps not. So welcome, Elliot, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So before we begin in earnest, because of what I said in the introduction, locate us in this place that straddles Europe and Asia with a bridge over the Bosphorus.
Well, I mean, you know, Istanbul is one of like the great, and I would say probably the original cosmopolitan city. I mean, it physically straddles two continents. It's where East meets West. And I think it's a place where you see culturally, politically, a lot of vibrance, but also a great deal of tension. And it's that political tension, which is also a personal tension, that underpins this book. So it's a story that takes place over a single day, and it alternates, you know, between that day and the past, you know, but it's also a story that alternates between the political and the interpersonal.
So what were the troubles, if you will, back in 2013?
You know, so the book takes place around nominally around the events of what was called the Gezi Park uprising. And Gezi Park is a centrally located park in Istanbul that was going to be developed by the current president, Tayyip Erdogan. And it basically, like many revolutions, sort of that was the spark that initiated sort of a blaze of discontent that had existed up to that point across Turkish society. So the characters in the book are living not only in the events around the Gezi Park protests, but also in their aftermath. And you start to see as you get deeper into their world, which is one, as you mentioned, of, you know, expatriates, spies, politicians, business people, the way they are all not only politically interconnected, but also personally interconnected.
Well, again, before we get into the novel itself, you know, oh, and yeah, in your interviews, you talk about how you love covers. So do I. And look, owning a bookstore, everyone says you can't judge a book by its cover, but every single person who comes in here judges a book by its cover. And yours is great because it's kind of a gnomon of everything in the book, including what William does. And so did you vet this cover? Did you decide what it was going to be? Were they people suggesting it? Because it really goes to the photograph that is a big part of the book.
Well, you know, photography is sort of an underpinning theme of the book. And so one of the nice things in that respect is that you have a book that is filled with lots of imagery. So I think it became sort of easy to, you know, pick which were the images. I did not pick that cover specifically. You know, the great people at Knopf did, and I think they do a really nice job with covers, but I like it very much. And on the cover, you'll see there's a photograph of a blackbird and a white bird, and that photograph appears at several places in the story.
And it's interesting how the idea of catching them just as they leave the wire is so much like catching the woman at exactly the right time when the pepper spray, and she looks like she's just nonchalant there. It's kind of like, well, it is like the picture of the kid in front of the tank in Tiananmen Square, the picture of the girl going Y at Kent State. How does something become like that? Just one instant.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, that's you're trying to take, I think that's what photography does so beautifully. You know, you're taking the impermanent and making it permanent. So, you know, any of those photographs that you just described, right, if you'd taken them a fraction of a second later, they wouldn't have meant as much or resonated nearly the way that they did. But you're catching that one moment. And I think why photography kind of wound up coming up in the book is because the book plays around a lot in time. And you're going back and forth through the present day action of the novel, which is this single day where Peter, the photographer you mentioned, and his lover, Catherine, are sort of fleeing the city, and back in time. So you kind of start to understand their backstories and what's informing their actions as they try to make this escape.
You know, all these people have their insecurities, except for Kristen. Well, yeah, pretty much. But it's funny how Peter's like, he took a picture of her, but it was the wrong time, and he's like dissing himself because he just didn't get it right, you know? He does that a lot.
You know, I know a lot of photographers too, you know, and they have like, I do a lot of work as a journalist, and I've, you know, worked with lots of photographers, and many of them have their stories of the, you know, oh yeah, man, you know that photo? Man, I was there too, but I didn't get it, you know? And it's, so it's, but you know, I think that's one of the things that makes it like a fascinating medium is that, you have to be there at the right time, see the right thing, and catch it. So it's sort of like photography as an art form is an art form of intersections. And when everything intersects perfectly, you wind up with that photograph, like the Tiananmen Square, the Kent State, or the one that's mentioned in Red Dress, or the, you know, the woman in the red dress, which was became the iconic photograph of that movement and moment in Turkish history.
It's like when someone says something to you and you want to come back, and then you're walking down the street and you go, oh, wow, yeah. I guess you said that.
Yeah.
Which I spend a good deal.
Well, there's a line in the book where Peter the photographer is talking to his young boy, kind of, you know, describing what he does. And he's like, you know, well, you know, some people say you have to take hundreds of bad photographs to get a single good one. You know, then he reflects later on. But, you know, sometimes you can just also take hundreds of bad photographs.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, it's different in today's world because you could just stop at each frame, which you didn't used to be able to do.
And it means things now.
Yeah. You know, I was going to ask you too, usually I say, okay, what's your book about? But instead of doing it that way, you know, I always know a book is good as if I can remember everybody's name. Mm-hmm. And so in this book, I know who William is. I know who Catherine is. I know who Murat is. I know who Peter is. So maybe if you just like give us a thumbnail sketch of each of the characters. Maybe starting with William, because I feel really sorry for him, you know?
Yeah, well, he's sort of the child who, you know, the book is about, you know, and there's a custody battle going on for him. And so his parents are a Turkish man named Murat, who is a real estate developer from a well-to-do family that has been a little bit down on its luck, but he is trying to kind of recoup the family business. And he is married to an American woman named Catherine, who is sort of, she was a dancer when she was younger, has always been sort of a bit of a lost soul, and, you know, wound up living the expatriate life married to Murat, but isn't like a deeply rooted person, kind of gets blown around a little bit in her own life. And when she's in a difficult spot in her marriage, she meets Peter, who is an American expatriate living in Istanbul. And to her, he's sort of a bright, shiny young thing He's trying to make his way, make a transition from doing more journalistic photography into more artistic photography. And that transition is very important for him. And that's when he meets Catherine, and she's more established in the city where he's trying to make a life for himself. And then sort of helping them out on the margins is Kristen. And Kristen is a official in the consular section at the embassy, or at the consulate in Istanbul. And she is sort of views herself, at least, is more of an established figure. She's a bureaucrat. She's not an artist like Peter necessarily, but she comes to support Peter's work with a couple of grants from the consulate. And so, yeah, those are sort of your key characters. And very early on in the book, sort of the precipitating action is Catherine has decided that she's going to leave her husband, Murad, and she brings her son, William, to a art exhibition one night in which Peter is present. And they have never agreed that Peter was going to meet her son. And that is sort of what the precipitating action that causes Murad to basically get very, very upset, which leads to a fight, which leads to Catherine running away, which leads to her running to Peter and saying that she's going to leave the city. See what happens.
Yeah, there's a lot of things. Well, there's incredible spoilers that I can ruin your whole book by saying them. But even in the beginning, without giving spoilers away, like Murad is a certain kind of person that you meet and you both feel sorry for him and you kind of want to kick him in the butt. But I mean, it's like, first of all, he's got this one inadequacy, kind of like a Hemingway kind of inadequacy. And then he's got, his father, and then he's got what he allows Catherine to be. And he just doesn't seem to have the spine that you kind of would expect him to have. And so, so a lot of these characters, the readers, and you're giving the reader the chance to do this, you expect him at some point to okay, man up.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting. I don't think any of the characters, or I hope they don't play to type.
They don't.
So, Murat's a big, he's a real estate developer in Turkey, and he's almost like a Trumpian figure, you could say, at least like from the outside. But you realize there's a lot more going on there. He himself had a very complex relationship with his father. He himself, when you look at Peter, had artistic tendencies. Murat began his career wanting to be an architect, wanting to be more involved in the artistic side of his family business until he realized in short order that that was not what was expected of him or would be possible for him. And he also has a very deep and abiding love for his son. You can read the book and make your own determinations. In my mind, he is a deeply flawed father, but he's a good father. And he won't just sort of let the boy go. He's not just gonna roll over on that account. And he fights. So, he's complex. I like to think that Peter is complex. He's put in the role of kind of being the knight in shining armor and trying to help Catherine escape this tough situation she's in. But he also has his own limitations. Which is that, he's not sure that Catherine's the person he necessarily wants to, run off with and make a life with. So, my hope in the book is that the characters, as you read, will continue to pleasantly and unpleasantly surprise you. Because I'm also, I don't think it's interesting to write books, too, where the characters are folks that, we always agree with every decision that they're making.
Yeah, it's like, this is really incredibly chauvinistic, but I kind of always think that women are crazy and guys like assholes. So Peter, you have a relationship and a woman says, it's time we move to the next level. And, the guy's sitting on the couch, he's got Frito scoop, he's got Lipton's French onion dip, he's watching a football game, he's got a beer. She's like, it's like the semi-ultimatum, but he's thinking, this is kind of comfortable.
Yeah.
I like this, mm-hmm. And Peter kind of is getting himself into that kind of thing. Like there's a moment in his room that I guess the first scene where he's by himself.
Right.
And he's thinking, I don't know. But then he, it's like it's like that movie Sliding Doors. It's kind of, you don't decide, life decides you.
Well, that's him exactly, is that he, you know, I think we've all met people like this and maybe felt our ways.
I've been that person.
Where you're, you know, you don't know what to do. And so inaction actually becomes your action. And so what happens when, in some respects, the hero, I'm not saying he's a hero in a heroic sense, but he is a hero in the book in that he's a central actor. When the characteristic of one of the central actors in the book is inaction. And so what winds up with Peter a lot is you see how other people act on him.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was what's so cool about the book. And again, like you said, the reader can do whatever he wants. But like when Marat and Peter are in Peter's apartment, mm-hmm. and you're thinking Marat is really exercising an enormous amount of power, but at the same time, I don't know, maybe he's not. But that's what, you know, that's what's really cool about it, because, you know, you're there thinking, I don't know, what the hell am I supposed to think? Which is great. Mm-hmm. And then the same thing like with Dennis, you know, you think, okay, first he's this guy, he's got, you know, without giving anything away, but then he does things that you wouldn't expect him to do. And he's really brave in so many ways and helpful and kind, mm-hmm. but you wouldn't expect that necessarily from the first night.
Right. And the hope is that, you know, just as people do in our lives, like people will surprise you with their strengths, even as you're very familiar with their flaws. So I think in this book, with most of the characters, they're, you know, some of creating the plot of the book is the order in which you're presenting character strengths and flaws to the reader. So that it has its sort of, so that that there's a propulsive aspect to it, so that you're kind of being, that at least I hope the reader's feeling as though they're surprised and learning about who these people are. And by the time you get to the end of the book, without giving it away, and you're understanding who the characters are and why they're making the decisions that they're making, you know, you realize that some of the characters who the reader maybe didn't know were exerting power, were in fact exerting power in profound ways.
Yeah, it's funny. When we talk about exerting power in profound ways, you know, like in the deist sense of thinking, you know, there's this divine watchmaker who winds the clock and then takes off. Kristen is kind of like that.
Yeah.
She's like the person who manipulates the marionettes.
And is in many ways in the greatest possession of herself.
Yes.
Even yeah. though in some respects, when you learn about her actions in the past, you realize that at times she's been the most out of control of any of the characters, even though you see how for whole stretches of the book, she is, you know, in the greatest control.
Yeah. And then you have this husband who doesn't appear, but still has this influence.
Right. And, who she keeps hidden, basically.
You know, who was my favorite character in the book? Mm-hmm. The parking lot attendant. Well, he was a nice guy, but then he finally gets sick of it. But up to a point, he's, you know, really a nice guy.
It's funny, you know, where that scene came from was I lived in Turkey for 3 years in Istanbul, and one day I was out, my brother was visiting me, and it was me, my brother, and my son, who was 2 at the time, and we were out walking in Bebek Park, where that scene is set. And we got stuck in this just insane, insane torrential downpour, like in the book. And we wound up standing in this empty parking, you know, little booth for like 45 minutes. We could not get out of this rainstorm. No time. There's no way to get out of there. And so anyways, I only just bring that up because it's funny how, you know, a year and a half later, I was writing about it, kind of imagining what it would be like to be stuck in that little attendance booth with a different cast of characters in a rainstorm.
And it's interesting, too, because here you have this little tiny space. And like you said, the whole thing is one day other than going back and forth. But so it's one day. And there's really, like you said, like 45 minutes. And she's in there with her son and the guy. And so much happens in there, especially mentally and internally in Catherine's mind. You know,
it's forced intimacy.
Yes.
Yeah.
But her relationship with this guy almost is like a reflection of her relationship with other people. Mm-hmm. And she switches midstream, no pun intended. She switches midstream into like, okay, now I'm going to take care of him before I want to be aloof.
Yeah, you know, and in that moment of the book, she, you know, she's really at a state of heightened crisis. And I think what I was seeing in her with regards to this parking lot attendant who she meets, you know, for all of an hour and a half, is her projection of where she's been, where she's going, all of her aspirations, all of her fears are onto this sort of poor guy she meets and all the things, you know, she can imagine for him, for herself, you know, in this moment of heightened crisis.
And the funniest part of that scene is when she goes, well, you don't know what my problems are. And he goes, well, I got my problems too. And they're so much worse. And but he's still, you know, very noble and generous about it. And especially with money.
I think he said, which I think is one of life's great truism, which is if, you know, you were to sit down with anyone and lay your problems on the table and have them lay their own problems on the table next to you, usually you walk away with your own problems. You're like, you know what, I'll keep mine.
Yeah, you know, I used to have this partner when I practiced law. And it's like, the one thing you couldn't say to him is, how are you doing? You couldn't go in the morning and say, how you doing, Phil? Because, and if you went in and, like, say you had a leak in your shower, then he would automatically, his whole house flooded and there was sewage coming out of the toilet and stuff like that. So I just stopped asking him because it wasn't worth it.
Yeah. How long do you want your morning to be?
Yeah, it's just like, you know, okay, I'll give it to you. Yeah. So like when we're talking about Kristen, I don't know how to really ask this without getting to the point. Oh, well, no, I will say one thing though about Murat, and you were saying he really loves his son. It is hard for him to express it. And in the beginning, he does put his arm around him once in the beginning. And then in the end, where I'm not going to spoil it, and he puts his arm around him again, but then he stops something from happening. Mm-hmm. That was really good because that was kind of it, right?
Yeah, well, the you know, to me, that felt true because no matter how much we love our kids, we're always going to fuck them up. And, you know, you're always like, I have kids. And God knows I love them. I love them. And I'm sure they're going to look back and there's going to be a million moments where I did the wrong thing. And I just felt like at that moment, you know, and towards the end of the book, for Murat to do the exact right thing at the last scene would suggest a degree of reconciliation with his relationship with his son going forward that just isn't accurate for anyone's son. So that the fact that he sort of flubs that last gesture, you know, isn't a comment on how much he loves the boy, you know, who's now growing up quite a bit.
Yeah.
On the fact that he can love him to the nth degree and his love will always be imperfect because all love is imperfect and we're all just sort of stumbling our way, you know, through these relationships. So, so again, it's just why that gesture felt like it should be there at the end of the book, that sort of last little flub, which I think is in accordance with his character.
Yeah, it's funny. It was kind of nice when you couldn't memorialize everything, but now I really don't like looking back, and I have a lot further back to look than you. Like when Michael and Katie were little. I mean, I look back. I don't like looking back at the videotapes because I see, why did I say that to him? Why did I say it that way? That had to shape a further aspect of his life. And I would prefer just not to have known that. And because with perspective, as a novelist, you know, with perspective, there's so much more there than when the actual action is happening.
Yeah. And you, you know, and that, again, for the book, too, it was that idea of, you know, you're taking a day that you know is going to be an important day. And you're kind of toggling between past and present because you're trying to show how the actions of that day are echoes of things that have happened in the years past and how the years past in history informs that you know that one day. And then by the time you get to the end of the book, you see how the events of that day really set these characters you know, on their future course. But you know, one thing that might not come across as much to American readers, because, you know, a lot of these events are not, you know, as much in our psyche, but is sort of a wink to people who follow Turkey or Turkish readers, is that the last day of the book in which, you know, we have our resolution and it seems as though things are settled, is the night before the 2016 coup in Turkey. So the coup is the next day.
Yeah, and when I researched all this and I saw the posters and the banners with the girl in the red dress, I realized I didn't know any of this stuff. And then I thought, okay, why did you decide that you were going to write this novel, which could have stood perfectly by itself, but it's, you know, it's this, it's the cover. And the cover has nothing to do with what happens on these days with these particular characters. It has something to do with something else. And you juxtapose that. These, like, again, with my buddy Phil, it's like, okay, there's these little problems that these people have, and then there's this enormous stuff going on. So how did you decide, when did you decide, like, you're going to, okay, here, I'm going to combine these two things like that?
Well, I think, you know, all politics is personal. And I think that it's, you know, it's interesting to see how a lot of these macro trends that exist politically have all of these kind of, you know, secondary and tertiary echoes in people's personal lives and the interpersonal relationships between people. So I wanted to kind of to tell this story where you're watching a intimate group of people in crisis and see how in some respects thematically it corresponds with a society that's in crisis and how the different aspects of that society that are underpinning it, you know, are brittle and fragile and don't all work together. And then you see this intimate group of people, you know, with Marat, with Catherine, with Peter. And when they have this kind of one day of crisis, you see how all of the connections between them are equally brittle and subject to manipulation. You know, so there's like a moment in the book where Peter is talking about the strategy of tension being he's trying to create this photography exhibit and he's got a project and he's thinking about the name is going to be the strategy of tension. And the strategy of tension is a real political or theoretical expression that dates back to the 1970s. And that's this idea actually was really widely used in Italy in the 1970s, but that the way you keep a society in balance and stable is to create threats, which are sometimes artificial, so that people will always have some external threat to fixate on. So like in Italy in the 1970s, when there was this big communist movement there, the right-wing government would support the communists because they wanted the communists to fight against, to juxtapose their power. And so that idea of kind of strategy of tension, of everyone being held in juxtaposition with each other, is one that manifests in Peter's work. It's one that manifests in the relationships between Marat, Kristen, Peter, and Catherine. And it's one that we see manifested in the politics of the moment in Turkey. And I also think for American readers is one that they will see manifested in our own society. Because, you know, they're, you know, I happen to believe that, like, people are people wherever you go in the world. Like, we're all sort of the same. We're the control mechanism in this human experiment. And when you look at other societies, I mean, God, you see, you know, you sure see parallels of your own. And I definitely saw that in, you know, in Turkey and the, you know, the populism that was existing in Turkey at that time, and the populism that exists in America right now, and the political dysfunction.
Yeah, I mean, even today, you can see that with, you know, we're in this, first of all, we're in this situation. It's really weird.
Right.
Incredibly weird. You know, the Chinese curse may live in interesting times. I mean, I'm old. I don't want to live in interesting times. I want to live in really boring times. You like to live in interesting times. But, you know, and yeah, you seem to thrive on interesting times, actually. But
I think as a writer, it's nice to, like, you know, when you step outside yourself, you can see yourself. So sometimes when you know, stepping outside of American society and writing a novel about Turkish society is a much easier way for me to write a novel about America.
Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of themes in this book that are, you know, very much themes that speak to the moment we're in the U.S.
When did you start writing it?
2015, 2016, you know.
Yeah, right. In the beginning of everything.
Right.
You know, it's funny. You're right, though. In all my travels, not as many as yours, but people are pretty much people. You know, people will say, oh, the French people are incredibly rude. They aren't. They're just regular. They're like us. You know, if you speak louder to them because you think if you're an American, you speak louder, they should understand you. Yeah, they're going to be pissed off. Right. I would be too. But it's the governments that are different. The people are pretty much the same everywhere.
And they are. And the differences I find are universally superficial. You know, you go anywhere in the world, you meet anyone, a stranger, within 5 minutes, you all probably start talking about your kids. You know what I mean? It's you know, people are generally the same. And so sometimes, though, when telling stories, I find it very natural to remove them from American life, you know, put them somewhere far away so that, you know, we're not taking all of our baggage into that story.
Yeah, it's funny because it's like if you read Ulysses by James Joyce, you know, the Nighttown part of Ulysses is just basically him writing down what he hears people saying at the bar. And I did that one time. I sat at a bar and I started writing down everything. And the woman next to me, she goes, what are you writing anyway? I said, I'm just writing what you're saying. It was really interesting. I couldn't write that well. And yeah, just like you remembering the parking lot, you know, it's just like it turned into an incredibly interesting scene and a kind of a pivotal scene in a way. But yeah, you know, and another interesting thing was you can read this in so many different ways. Like when, you know, Peter has that showing in kind of a makeshift gallery at Dennis's house. And everybody ends up looking at the picture in which they're in and joking with each other and all that. And then Peter's outside and he takes one picture of that.
Right.
And whoever says it, maybe Catherine says it, you just wanted to do that so you could take that picture, right? And then you think differently about Peter a little bit. Something pivots in your mind.
Well, and that's the that's sort of the, you know, the idea of how you show those characters with these kind of little gestures, right? And in that scene, he's basically, you know, he has taken a bunch of photographs of, you know, one of the things that was interesting at the Gezi Park riots is the people who were really on the forefront of those riots was the transgender, transsexual community in Turkey or in Istanbul, because they, you know, the LGBTQ community there has been, like, you know, persecuted for years and years and years and years. And so when these kind of everyday Turkish citizens decided they were going to stand up at Gezi Park, the people who'd been protesting the longest was that community. And so the saying became among Turks was that, you know, the toughest men at the barricades at Gezi were the transgender women, because they've been on the forefront of this for the longest time. And so at the opening of the book, Peter has set up this exhibition of a number of portraits, all of them. And he then, you know, they then come kind of, you know, dressed or whatever, they're going to dress nicely for the evening, and they're staring at the portraits of themselves. And he decides actually what he wants to take is this photograph of each of them standing in front of their own portrait, them sort of beaten up and then them dressed up, and the juxtaposition of the two. And so that's sort of when you're introduced to Peter in the opening pages of the book, is how he sets that up and how the various characters kind of react to his setup when they learn about it.
And it's interesting that you talk about tension, too, because, you know, Peter's first project that he has nervousness about is this idea of tension, of two photographs, like the birds, of two people on either side in a relationship that could go either way. But he's not happy with it necessarily. But why are you, which I assume you are, interested in this concept of duality and, you know, things like being about ready to burst one way or the other?
Because I think, you know, so much of life is kind of held in like these in a delicate balance, whether we choose to see and acknowledge the balance or whether we don't. You know, for instance, like, I think this is probably a time when lots of people are seeing and being forced to see and acknowledge the delicate balance that exists in all of our lives, as we see so much of what we thought was immutable kind of just slough away, and we're, you know, got all of our, you know, shut stores, lost jobs, people sick. But I think that even goes deeper into, you know, people's internal tension that they feel, you know, the lives that they're living and how resigned they are necessarily to those lives. And so what we kind of see is one person snaps and says, I'm going in a different direction, which is Catherine at the opening of the book. And as the reader, you see how widely that decision reverberates out And societies do the same thing. You know, nobody expects the revolution until the revolution happens. And when you look at the precipitating event, right, it's always something sort of ridiculous. And you're not ridiculous, but something that you wouldn't think would be the precipitating event. You know, whether it's a, you know, in our country, it's a tea tax, right? Or in the Arab Spring, it's a fruit seller puts himself on fire, you know? Or in the case of Gezi Park, we'd say, what happened to Gezi Park? I mean, it was some protesters who were protesting. When you go to Gezi Park, it's just a little scrap of grass inside Turkey, but they were going to bulldoze and concrete on top of it. And it led to this entire nationwide, you know, revolutionary movement. So, you know, everything is always about to snap, whether we acknowledge it or not. And Peter, the photographer, is kind of someone who's always looking and trying to make those tensions that are invisible, visible.
Yeah. And as we talked about earlier about symbols, you know, accompanied by these minor incidents that, whether it's Franz Ferdinand or whether it's the economy of Germany and whether it's the Times making the Man or the Man making the Times, there always are these symbols like the red dress or something like that. And that also is a tipping point. If you want to go Malcolm Gladwell kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. And they are. I mean, you pile up sand at the beach and sooner or later it goes one way or the other. And we're no more important than the sand anyway, so it doesn't make much difference. But
it seems these days too, just with cycles of information, news cycles, everything in our lives being accelerated, it seems as though those tipping points or those moments, there seem to be more of those moments that we consume globally today than, you know, well, I don't know, when I look back at history, I wonder if they were experiencing, you know, or let me just say, I often feel like I'm binge watching history. Like just, you know, things are, it's like, what's going to happen today? Like, you know, I'm thinking of this year, like we're going to kill Qasem Soleimani in Iran. All right. You know, in January, we're going to war with Iran. By the end of February, there's a global pandemic. You know, I mean, I'm like, I'll talk to my wife. I'm like, well, what's going to happen by the fall? I mean, we've got a presidential election, but who else knows what's going to happen?
There's not going to be any election.
I know. It's too much. It's too much. I can't.
All I know is that the happiest person in the world right now is Dr. Sanjay Gupta.
Yes.
And Chris Cuomo in his basement. I mean, and I shouldn't even be watching any of this stuff, but it's just.
It's surreal.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, like 5 years ago, my buddy here in the bookstore, Mike, you know, I started saying, you can't make this stuff up. You can't make this stuff up. But now you can't say that anymore because it's way beyond that. I don't know what the next expression would be. Because I thought an ultimate was you can't make this stuff up. But now it's so far beyond that.
It's just things just come. I just feel like there's too much of it. Like there's too many events to even digest.
So I've decided I just tell everyone we're doomed.
Yeah.
And that seems to work. And yeah, it's like you know, and I, you know, when you started talking about Trump, if you went a little further, I'd go off on one of my rants and it would be, you know, that would be the end of the interview because it would just be me ranting for 25 minutes. But, you know, my rants are getting old, too. It's like, again, I have this book that I just found in the bookstore called Nazism, and it was written in 1934. And it's all these people who are writing about it, who are so prescient about it. They know what's going to happen. And we're all here, too, like kind of knowing this is wrong. The way we're going is wrong. And like Einstein said, there's not going to be a World War IV, you know.
He said, I wrote about this once. He said World War III will be a nuclear. He said if the Third World War is a nuclear war, the Fourth will be fought with sticks and stones.
Right. Yes. There was another one I was thinking of, but now I forgot what it is. But it was a good one. I'll think of it after the interview's over.
Yeah.
But yeah, so then the other thing about the book is, not to kind of beat a dead horse, but okay, so you got this major, major thematic thing, which is what's going on in a country and how pivotal it is during a particular day, and as you gave away, during the last day as well. And then you have the characters, who, as I said at the beginning, there's all these themes, whether it's romance, whether it's mystery, whether it's intrigue, whether it's sexuality, whether it's whatever, revolution. And then, but you also decide to add this third element, the one I can't talk about, that changes the relationships between pretty much, well, William, between Catherine, Marat, not Peter necessarily, Dennis for sure, and Kristen. So how the hell did you get there? I mean, how the hell did you get to that part?
Well, I think you could sort of see the, you know, that they were all connected. And there's one line connecting all of them together. So that when each one moves, it affects every other. You know, and it just became obvious to me what that one through line was for all of them. You know, and I don't think it spoils anything to say that it's, you know, it's William, it's the child.
Yeah. So,
And so you see how each one of them, each of their actions is informed by the others. So, and there's a simplicity to that. And even I would say Peter to a degree, even though he's kind of an unwinning actor. And I think the important thing is that, you know, the book ends with Peter and William.
And Peter, to his credit, walks one way instead of the other on a specific day. And William is just kind of like, he's just good. I mean, from the moment he's playing Simon in the backseat of the car,
yeah,
till the last day with his father.
Where he gets upset, you know, and like they're going to buy clothes and he gets upset at his mother.
Yeah.
So he's, you know, these things are, but you're seeing how they're washing over him. And I, you know, when I was writing him and thinking about him, I'm like, we're seeing the emotional architecture of his life as it's being built. So, you know, we don't see him when he's 20 or 30, but we see the events that are probably going to inform who he becomes. And as the book's ending, you're just starting to see him kind of growing into that adult. Like you can see a glimmer, you can see sort of flickers of it in the last scene.
Yeah, and, you know, at first I thought, you know, he's too young to be this. And it's nice the way he had Peter's camera around his neck. But, you know, he's too young to be this, I don't know, knowledgeable, or that's not the right word. And then I realized, you know, I know some kids that are like that who are 12. And my youngest daughter, Annie, is like that, too. And everyone goes, oh, she's an old soul, that kind of thing. But yeah, so kids are like that. They're smart. They sound like, you know, it's like people, parents talk about the kids and they think the kids aren't realizing what's going on at the time. Like when William's upstairs and they're downstairs, he knows what's going on.
You know, I have with my kids, and it always blows me away, but I'll have, and they'll come up to me, you know, and my kids, I mean, I have two stepkids in my two, so I've got four, and they're ages 8, 9, and 12. Even the little ones will come up to me and they'll be like, hey, Dad, like, remember that time, blah, blah, blah. And it'll be like, something that happened 2 years ago. Like, you know, and they will, and this happened and that happened. And they will have a complete grasp of what it was that was going on in a way that, frankly, kind of I find chilling, because in my mind, I'm like, oh, they didn't remember that. You know, it was water under the bridge. They didn't know that was going on. I'm like, no, we knew exactly what was going on.
Well, yeah. And then you think of yourself, because you did, too.
Yeah, because you did, too. Exactly. So, you know, the psychology of a child and what a child picks up on, at least in my, it always is just sort of, you know, it blows me away. Or even the things that they might not in the moment pick up on, but a year or two later just connects for them. You know, it's fascinating to me.
Yeah, it really is. Little things like, you know, my brother and I would hang out at the landing at the top of the stairs when my parents were having parties below, you kind of like catch what's going on. It was helpful.
Yeah. Well, and it's, and, you know, I think as adults, we often make mistakes. We think that kids aren't picking up everything that they're picking up. We underestimate them too often.
Yeah, I know. And then also for the couple involved and the kids, you know, there's always those things that you can't unsay, like family, couples in a fight and one says, I hate you. Yeah. You can't untake that.
Yeah.
The kid hears that. I mean, like you were saying earlier, those are the things that pivot you through life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a lot of those things in this book too. And a lot of the scenes that are drawn that symbolically mean a lot. Kind of like I said, like when Murat picks up the two pictures and he's not impressed.
Right.
Like later on at the end, when he sees the gallery, then he says, yeah, I kind of get this now.
Yeah. And, you know, and you see how at the end, you know, there's a lot of action over that one day with William and Peter, but they don't, you know, there's not a lot of interaction after that day, but they see each other at the end. And, you know, what I think is unsaid is how each, you know, has an understanding of how they've affected the other.
Yeah. Kind of to conclude this, I guess. Well, I always talk too much in these things. It's like I'm interviewing myself. What am I telling you about my friend? Anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's kind of, no pun intended, to bookend it, because the first thing that Peter and William really interact on is when he lets them have his camera and he gets that picture. Yeah. And then that's
the end. Yeah, that's the photograph.
Yeah.
Yeah. And interpreting the photograph together.
Okay. That's a good time to end, I think, right?
Right.
This is Bree, Sam's engineer. You would think he would stop the interview there, but as you'll see in a second, he just keeps going. So enjoy the rest.
All right, that was cool.
Yeah, that was cool. How are things going at the bookshop?
Here I am.
That's it. Are you guys doing like mail order?
Yeah, and it's funny. It's like, you know, I'm so sick of people saying the new normal. It's like saying safe travels or have a blessed day or take care. I hate when people say that stuff.
Yeah.
When they say take care, I said, nah, I don't. No, I'm not going to. So the new normal is, yes, all of a sudden we're selling all this shit, you know, and then the kind of curbside thing and all that, and book clubs by Zoom. Like, so I'm doing the book club, and it's like there used to be like 6 or 7 people there. Now with the Zoom, you got all these people because they don't have to worry about the size of the shop. Or they don't have to get off their ass. They can just sit there. So all of a sudden you have all these people and they're all going to buy the book. So yeah, it's kind of like,
yeah, and I'm interested for this book, you know, cause I've never done it this way. I've done it, you know, this is my fifth book. So like, part of me is like, you know, you go to the bookstore, people got to get off their ass. They got to drive to the bookstore. You do the reading. Part of me is like, I don't know, maybe you're going to get more people doing, cause I'm doing a bunch of Zoom events and Instagram events. And I'm like, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe it's going to go better because people don't have to get off their ass. They just like, you know, roll over, tune in. I'll be interested to see how this shakes out because I think some of this will translate over to post this moment, you know, where I don't know, maybe it does. I don't know.
Well, it's like, I mean, look at all the traveling you do for specific purposes. I mean, when I went to China last time, there's all these kids, call them kids, that are, they're being sent to China by their company, but I don't know exactly why they're being sent to China.
Right.
And I watch them on their computers and they're not doing work. They're playing games.
Yeah.
And then they get over there and I guess they go out to dinner. They stay at a nice hotel.
Mm.
They do the deal. They come back. But if it's a good deal, it would be done anyway, you know? And it's like,
yeah, I think for airline travel, it's going to be, I was reading that like Warren Buffett unloaded all of his airline position.
Yeah.
He's like airlines. It's like a new day for the airlines.
Yeah. And then what about the stock market? It's going crazy. I mean, if you invested in Wayfair 3 weeks ago, you quadrupled your money. It's like,
Yeah, it's crazy right now because nobody knows anything. Like no one, there's just so much volatility out there.
Yeah. I don't know if I already said this, but you know, people come up to me every day and they go, what do you think will happen? And I go, I don't know. What do you think will happen?
Yeah, nobody knows what's going to happen. I mean, the only thing when I get really down about it, I'm like, fuck, when I'm like, God, we're going to be doing this for 3 years. Like, I'm like, you know, this 1919 influenza epidemic is called the 1919 influenza epidemic because it lasted from 1919. it's like we had the roaring 20s. Like, you know, we can do that here too.
Yeah. And you're talking about kids. So your kids are going to tell their kids and their grandkids, you don't remember, you know, you think you're stuck in the house for the day. I was stuck in the house.
You know, the guy's kids I really feel bad for are only children. Because my kids are in the other room, and they're, you know, they're in the other room, and they got their three siblings, and they're palling around, and we're at my wife's place, which is a little bit in the country, so they can be outside. It's not a big deal. Like, they're fine. You know what I mean? Like, one of my son's best friend, and his teacher's a math teacher, so she teaches all day on Zoom, and he's like in the city, and you know, and he hasn't seen anybody. You know, and like they FaceTime, but like for you're single, you know, you're an only child. This is tough.
Yeah, I know. And it's like, like with you, I mean, do you go out? Do you like go to the store? What do you do?
We go, I'm in Delaware. So we usually are like halftime in New York City and in Washington, D.C. Here. So, yeah. So we go to Walgreens, we go to the grocery store. That's about it. We have a couple friends who live in the area who will like invite over because we know like they're not going anywhere. They just sit on their house at their house all day. And so, you know, once a week we'll have like dinner with another couple. That's about it. You know what I mean?
What we do is we have like this cocktail party where I set all the chairs like 6 feet apart. And then my girlfriend, makes like 6 charcuterie platters, nice. One for each little group of people. That's kind of fun, but it's weird too. But yeah, it's, I don't know. The reason I was asking you is because it seems like, you know, shit, from reading your introduction, it's like, you know, you're just all over the place and you're doing all kinds of things. So it seems like for you, it would even be even worse because when's the next time you're going to get on a plane? When's the next time you're going to a Washington Nationals game.
Well, that, you know, the thing for me, it's been like before this happened, I would say I was not in the same place for more. I would be in one place for 4 to 5 days tops. Be up in the same places, like I'd be in New York, and then I'd go here, and I, you know, I would just a lot of that in my just got built into my life over the years, and I can't remember the last time I was in one place as long as I've been where I am right now. Which in some ways is nice. Like, you know, I've got work I'm doing and projects I'm working on, and I'm really like getting, you know, good time to be sitting in one place thinking. But, you know, it's tough. You get to a certain point, like, you know, my wife, I'm sure we kind of want our life back now.
Yeah, I know. It's funny because
we just want to see our friends. You know, we just want to see our friends. Like, we just want to go to like, you know, our favorite restaurant and have dinner with like 3 of our good friends.
I'm saving money.
Yeah, me too.
I have cash, you know. It's like I have cash in my pocket because I always take cash. I take 50s out of the bank,
yeah.
And they're still there. They never were there. They was gone to restaurants or tips or whatever. Now they're just sitting there. Yeah, but it's
when I was in the Marines and I got back from Iraq, I remember we like went crazy. Like we not crazy, but we were like we just partied really hard. Like we had like such a like joie de vivre. Like yeah, like where I remember I am one summer like you know I ran with the Bulls. I did Fleet Week in New York. Like I was just you know go with this group of friends of mine. And, you know, and I realize now like in retrospect, you know, like we were processing a lot. You know, we were kind of understanding what this experience meant. But there was all this pent up just desire to live. And I'm like. Whenever this thing rolls back, like America is going to party for a little while. And it might not be like, you know, there's going to be a great release.
Yeah. But that's the thing is it's not going to be like one day. That's the problem. It's going to be like, how is it going to happen?
Yeah.
And the other thing is like, the other thing I think of is like, in the beginning, it was really weird. Then it got to be like, okay, it's regular. Now it's like, I'm really sick of this.
Well, I think you're seeing it when people like America is opening up. It's like people are just, I think, collectively saying like, fuck it. I don't care. I'm going to wash my hands and let it ride. You know what I mean?
And then who knows what that's going to do too.
Right. But I think you're seeing a lot of that. People are just being like, this is too bad. Like, it's too much. It's too much. Like I don't live in Manhattan. I'm wherever I am. Like, I'm just going to let it ride. And who knows how that's going to go?
I don't know. If I was in Utah, I wouldn't be inside.
But you say that, but like, or not Utah, Idaho was one of like the big, in Sun Valley was a huge.
Oh, right. Yeah. It's very strange.
Yeah. It's weird.
Oh, so did you, I mean, do you miss the idea of doing a tour for your book or did you not?
Yeah. You know, I mean, you love getting out there and talking to people and, you know, and seeing the book out in the world and meeting people who've read it. Like, it's great. You know, like, I really enjoyed this. Like, but so I'll miss that. I really feel for like a debut writer, you know, like when it's your first one.
Yeah.
You know, that really sucks, you know, like, you know, I know what my writing life is like, and I, you know, have this book and I have other projects that are in the hopper that I'm working on. So I'm like, hey, you know, it's, you know, I don't get to do it for this one, but we'll do it the next time. For a debut writer, it's like really, you know, just it's got to sting.
Yeah. And the other thing is, it's good for me because I can get any author in the world now because they got nothing else to do. You're not going to talk to me. You have nothing else to do right now. So I might as well talk to this guy. You know, what the hell?
What I have to do next? I have to go and make a Model Zero fighter plane for my stepson.
That's more important. I'll let you go.
I've got like, if you were just look at the tips of my fingers, they're like crusted in super glue.
Oh, I always hate that. Especially that stuck together.
Yeah, it hurts.
Like the time I stapled my brother's fingers together back in the old days before there was super glue.
Back when before there was COVID.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was fun.
Yeah, this thanks for doing it.
Go ahead.
I just say thanks for doing it. I appreciate it. It's, you know, I appreciate the close read of the book. You know, it's fun for me because it's just getting out in the world. So I think you're like maybe the second or third person I've talked to about it. So it's fun for me.
Well, the cool thing about the book, and you know, I'm not trying to compliment you, but I mean, it's when you read it and, you know, it's not like I'm such a great close reader, although I did take the Evelyn Wood speed reading course.
I should probably take
I read The Pearl by John Steinbeck in 17 minutes, and I read Sink the Bismarck in 17 minutes. Amazing how you can do it. But anyway, so the thing about the book is that the reason why it seems like I've read it so closely is because it's good. So you, like I said, it's like, even though I don't agree with her, when I read Ayn Rand when I was a kid, I can still remember Dagny Taggart. I can still remember Howard Roark and Hank Reardon and Keith Powell. I remember all the characters' names because it just drew you in. Yeah. And there's not that many here, but I'm not going to forget their names. I'll know it if someone asks me in 10 years.
One, because you were interested in the cover. The original cover was actually going to be the woman in the red dress. And the lawyers at the publishing house got worried that like they might do something. So we switched it to the two birds, which I actually like more now in retrospect. I think it's a more evocative image. But at the time, I was like all bummed out about it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, well, like I said, looking at stuff online, you know, her picture in so many different stylistic ways is everywhere. That's cool.
Yeah, but you see interviews she's done, she's like actually very resentful about how her image has been reproduced. She doesn't like it.
Yeah, so she doesn't want to be involved.
Yeah. So.
And then I was pepper sprayed once from a distance. It was horrible. And that picture's like, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, I've been pepper sprayed too. It's not fun.
Now in the Peter, I mean, you got it worse than anybody. But and I would have gone crazy because I would have thought I was blind. And you say that.
Like he does. And not good to be blind if you're a photographer.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
All right.
Cool.
Thanks a lot.
Be well. Wash your hands.
Stay safe.
Stay safe.
All right, man. I'll see you. Bye.
So we were talking with Elliot Ackerman, who's got an incredible resume. Like I said, he's 40 years old. He's written 5 books. Five tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, Bronze Star, Silver Star, has been a White House fellow, travels all around the world. In fact, you know, because of the situation, he's so cooped up, it's even different than us. He just wants to get out. He's never stayed in the same place more than 4 or 5 days at a time. And at the age of 40, he's done so much. Just amazing, amazing guy. In any event, the book, you know, it's red dress and black and white. So at first you might think it's like, you know, a chick book or something like that, but it's not at all. And the cover kind of gives you an idea of what it's about. It's about Turkey, Istanbul, revolution, sexuality. It's kind of a mystery. It's kind of a romance. There's a comedic aspect to it. It's really, really a good book. And it draws you in from the beginning. And I really enjoy talking to him. It was kind of a wide-ranging conversation, and that's what's happened, I think, since all of this corona stuff. People want to talk to each other. They enjoy it. There's a certain lightheartedness about it. So anyway, had a great time. So thanks as always for joining us. And now that, you know, we're not doing this on the radio and it's just a podcast because the station's closed, but there's other reasons too. So in the future, you can always check it out on our website, on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter, Spotify, but you can go to Podomatic, and then you can also go to iTunes and find all of these listed, all of the 500-600 of them all the way back. But Podomatic is a really nice, clean way to do it, and you can always get the link from the website, which will take you there immediately. Oh, yeah, so I forgot to mention, since I can do that now because I'm posting them one at a time on Podomatic, our next talk, our next interview will be a really cool one with Suvankam Themavangsa, who is a poet, but this first book of short stories is called How to Pronounce Knife. That story won an award. Her poetry has won lots of awards, and these stories are gems. And it's about mostly about Laotians, people from Laos who've come to America and suffer and find themselves in miserable situations, but there's always an ounce of hope in each story. And amazingly, there's also a bunch of humor. So look forward to that one. And as always, thanks for joining us today, and you can join us next week as well on the Avid Reader.